watch Marty edit The Color of Money at his New York office. A middle-aged woman stepped into the elevator, gasped, and told Paul how much she adored him in the towering inferno. He flashed his grin. Then she started calling him Steve, as in McQueen, his co-star. Paul played along, but I could see he was about to crack up. When we reached the woman's floor, she said, "Steve, it was so great to meet you." And Paul said, "You should take a better look at my co-star, Paul Newman. He's a fine actor and a really good guy." The Color of Money grossed more than $52 million in North America, nearly four times its cost. Disney was ecstatic. Marty was giddy with relief. "You know, Marty," I told him, "you could actually get paid for being a film director." Before we signed him, his price was in the low six figures, and he never shared in his movie's profits. We would raise his price to $3 million. By the mid-80s, we'd made all our directors $3 million guys. There weren't any women directing then, unfortunately, and 5 years after that, we established our top directors as $5 million guys. It was CAA's first hit package with an auteur director and two big dramatic stars. However, I still owed Marty The Last Temptation of Christ, an unpackageable disaster in the making. It was tainted by incendiary content, weak curb appeal, and the stigma of Paramount's rejection. Yet Marty wanted to make Last Temptation, he told me, more than anything in the world. I shared neither his passion for it nor his belief in it, but just getting the thing released would make CAA look heroic. Marty offered to cut the budget in half to $7 million by switching locations from Israel to non-union Morocco, paying the actors at scale and slicing his own fee to the bone. Before going to the studios, we created a financial model for the film, a matrix of expenses and revenue streams, domestic, foreign, video rentals, network, and cable TV pre-buys. We projected Last Temptation's worst-case loss, with zero ticket sales, at $20 million. A medium scenario cut the loss to $5 million. So who owed us a seven- or eight-figure favor? $20 million sounds like a hugely expensive good turn, but it's all relative. 2 years earlier, MCA Universal had fattened on two CAA packages, Back to the Future, a $350 million worldwide gross on a $19 million budget, and Out of Africa, $266 million worldwide. It was time for them to reciprocate by taking Last Temptation. Because Marty needed a permanent office where he could cut his films by hand with his longtime editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, we'd ask for that, too. All of Marty's needs in one big favor package. In October 1986, MCA named the entertainment lawyer Tom Pollock chairman of Universal Pictures. It seemed like a radical choice, but Tom was a discerning reader who knew film economics cold. He'd made creative deals as early as 1973, when he negotiated George Lucas 20% of the net in lieu of a salary on American Graffiti. Tom's handiwork financed the Star Wars trilogy and made Lucas's career. We loved Tom because he made development deals with a number of CAA directors, including Ivan Reitman, Bob Zemeckis, John Hughes, and Ron Howard, and his producer, Brian Grazer. Universal under Pollock was a throwback to the old Hollywood system, only with an agency in the middle. I knew the studio would work to land a talent magnet like Marty, just as we had. An enterprising guy like Tom could be persuaded to see Last Temptation as a loss leader. I pitched the movie as part of a broader deal for Universal to get first look at all Scorsese projects. Later, I wove in the other goodies we wanted, the overhead to run Marty's company out of the MCA building in New York, edit facilities, and a screening room. Tom hedged his bet on Last Temptation by bringing in a financial partner, Garth Drabinsky's Cineplex Odeon chain, but he agreed to bankroll the film even before Marty signed to do something more commercial. There was one last loose end. Because Last Temptation had gone into turnaround at Paramount so late in development, more than the usual sum had been sunk into sets, costumes, props, and location costs. Frank Mancuso, Paramount's studio chief, had already waived $3 million. When I asked Frank to forgive the last million on the books, as Universal was demanding, he let it go without a fight, remembering that he'd just had Top Gun from us. The business in those days was more like a family. Everybody bitched and groused, but we all took care of each other, confident that the favors would come back around. The smooth sailing lasted 5 minutes. Then Universal resisted Marty's choice of Brooklyn-accented Harvey Keitel to play Judas. Harvey was one of Marty's boys, along with De Niro and Joe Pesci, and we told Tom Pollock it was futile to fight it. They had to let Marty do the movie his way. Last Temptation was more than a movie for him. It was a profession of his faith, and he doubted he could do it justice. I called him every other day in Morocco as he battled the worst angst of his life. By the time the 8-week shoot wrapped on Christmas Day, the religious right was beginning to rumble. I wasn't troubled by the small early protests or by the offer from Campus Crusade for Christ to buy the film for $10 million so it could burn all the existing prints. Maybe the local news would pick up the story, I thought. I was a sucker for free publicity. I was naive. In July 1988, a few weeks before it opened, Last Temptation landed on the cover of both Time and Newsweek as a brewing controversy. A so-called reverend denounced these Jewish producers with a lot of money. There was fundamentalist street theater outside Lou Wasserman's home in Beverly Hills, with the guy playing Lou planting his foot on Christ's back. As the FBI logged assassination threats from the Aryan Nation, a bloody pig was delivered to Wasserman's number two, Sid Sheinberg. Lou didn't scare, but Sid came unglued. He called me from his home one morning and said, "Mr. Ovitz, we were friendly. I was friendly with anyone who ran a studio, but he always addressed me and everyone else as Mr." A gangly 6'2" exec with a pockmarked face, Sid was Lou's longtime whipping boy. Knowing he was never going to get Lou's job, he took his rage out on others, but there was a purity to his animus. When he compared me to an agent for Mossad, the Israeli intelligence agency, I took it as a compliment. "Yes, Sid. Mr. Ovitz, I would like to inform you that 100 people with placards are marching up and down in front of my driveway, and my family is quite frightened. Sid, I'm really sorry. Should I come over? You won't be able to get through." It was my job to anticipate public opinion, and I felt I'd failed. I worried about Marty's future. Could I even have cost Tom his job at Universal? As the frenzy peaked, Marty asked me to join him for the film's debut at the Venice Film Festival. Judy and I left early for a weekend on the French Riviera. Our first morning there, out for exercise on a racing bike, I headed down a steep road by the hotel. A mile or so out, a sports car cut me off and I swerved onto the cobblestone shoulder. My bike jackknifed, and I flew into a low rock wall. I woke up in the hospital in the worst pain of my life. I had 4 broken ribs, a punctured lung, and a concussion. Hours later, in a medication fog, I called Marty to tell him Venice was out. He was nice about it, though he kept saying, "Are you sure you can't come? It doesn't sound so bad." The rest was anticlimax. The movie ran largely without incident and grossed about $8 million. Universal broke even. John Avnet, Marty's producer on the film, later credited me with having made that film happen and said I willed it into existence. I appreciated the salute, but the best thing about Last Temptation was the day it was behind me. Once Marty joined us, I knew that Bob De Niro, who'd starred in 5 of Scorsese's films, was sure to follow. I had never bought the agenting 101 rule that representing 2 similar stars is a conflict of interest. Instead, I preached, no conflict, no interest. We wanted all the conflicts because that gave us leverage. The studios couldn't threaten us that they'd opt for a similar piece of talent at another agency. 3 guys competed for roles in Bob's category of the character actor leading man. Bob, our client Dustin Hoffman, and Al Pacino. Dusty's fee in the mid-80s was $6.5 million, about the same as the other 2, and as Newman and Redford, pure leading men who played versions of themselves. The only actors who earned more, a lot more, were the action heroes, Stallone and Schwarzenegger. Also, and crucially, the conflicts were always more apparent than actual. I canvassed our files, and there wasn't one film Dustin had done in the previous 5 years, from Kramer vs. Kramer to Tootsie, that De Niro would have wanted. After making the same point to Dusty, who agreed with the logic, that he wouldn't have wanted to be in Raging Bull or The King of Comedy, I pitched De Niro on the idea that it was better for everyone if CAA cornered the market on leading men. All the best parts would flow into our agency and be parceled out to whoever fit them best. In the unlikely event that 2 stars wanted the same role, we'd talk it out. It never happened. Using the same logic, we would sign Al Pacino a few years later, after he stopped asking us to cut our commission to 5%. All three stars thrived at CAA at the peak of their popularity, and we got better deals for all of them. Though the studios always tried to pretend that if De Niro didn't take a role at their price, they'd go to Hoffman, we already knew Hoffman didn't want it. We even packaged Pacino and De Niro as dual leads in Heat, a big hit by the brilliant director Michael Mann. Of all our clients, De Niro was the most private, even more private than Redford. He didn't act like a movie star and couldn't stand being treated like one. Meryl Streep, who lived down the street from us in Brentwood and who took her turn in the school carpool, was the same way. Shortly after Bob signed, I met with him in Matsuhisa, the yet-to-be-discovered Japanese place on La Cienega. It was a hole in the wall, but Nobu Matsuhisa's cooking was fantastic, and he'd converted a studio above an adjoining garage into a private room you could secretly enter from the parking lot. Perfect for Bob. As Nobu's gracious wife served us one knockout dish after the next, Bob kept glancing over my shoulder or through the small window. A 4-star meal in Los Angeles in total anonymity. He couldn't believe it. He went back 3 times in 10 days before I joined him again and introduced him to Nobu. They had a passionate conversation about food and New York, beginning a friendship that would later lead them to become partners in Nobu's restaurant in Tribeca, Bob's home neighborhood. Like Paul Newman, Bob had made some iffy choices as an actor for hire. I explained to him how our clients controlled their own projects, and Bill Haber suggested putting the producer Jane Rosenthal into his life. Jane worked with us to develop strong roles for Bob in The Untouchables, Midnight Run, Awakenings, and Backdraft. She and Bob co-founded the Tribeca Film Center and still work together today. It's hard to believe now that some of the films we assembled at CAA ever got made. Goodfellas, adapted by Marty Scorsese and our client Nick Pileggi from Nick's book, was a textbook risky idea. It was the true story of Henry Hill, a cocaine-addicted stool pigeon who beats his wife and pistol whips an unarmed man, even as his mobster friends casually shoot people in the head. On paper, at least, Henry was wildly unsympathetic. 9 years before The Sopranos aired, we had no way of telling if the movie could be commercial. After Universal passed, I brought it to Bob Daly and Terry Semel at Warner Brothers. They wanted the running time held to 140 minutes max, and they approved a lean $25 million budget. Our first clash came over casting. Warner was a star-driven studio, and Goodfellas' lone star was De Niro, in a supporting role. Ray Liotta had wowed De Niro in Something Wild, and Marty decided that Ray should be Henry Hill. The studio tossed out bigger names from Tom Cruise to Eddie Murphy, a classically terrible studio idea that would have led to some extremely acrobatic story changes, and it was prepared to raise the budget to accommodate a star. But Marty thought too much star power would overwhelm the story, so I held firm, which made De Niro appreciate how I'd fight for what he wanted. Today, it's impossible to imagine anyone but Ray Liotta as Henry Hill. He had to play 4 distinct characters, the wannabe wise guy, the mature wise guy, the out-of-control addict wise guy, and the schnook in the witness protection program. Goodfellas inspired the performance of his life. I'd read all the great books on Hollywood's history and seen every Oscar-winning film going back to 1929, but I didn't get movies until I started watching them with Marty in the late 80s when he rented a 1-bedroom apartment in my building in Manhattan on West 57th Street. After getting in from L.A. at 1 in the morning, I'd drop my bags at my place, rap on Marty's door, grab a plate of food, and sit in front of whatever was playing that night on his projector. Marty was a walking film encyclopedia, and the fare ranged from Michelangelo Antonioni to obscure Czech and Polish directors from before World War II. He adored the work of Michael Powell, the husband of his editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, and screened The Red Shoes over and over. There was nothing better than walking into a dark room with a projector flickering, showing an old movie I'd never heard of but that might one day influence Marty's own work. That dark room became one of the few places in my increasingly busy life where I felt at home. My schooling continued on the set of Goodfellas, where Marty let me shadow him. I learned the importance of detail and how planning and inspiration could coexist. I took a master class in the film's soundtrack, one of the best scores anywhere ever. When Henry Hill runs from the narcs to Harry Nilsson's Jump into the Fire, Marty used no dialogue. Music was all he needed to propel the action. Warner's main concern was the film's graphic violence. When we screened Marty's 175-minute rough cut for the execs, two scenes particularly troubled Bob Daley. The first occurred right after the opening credits, when you could hear Joe Pesci's character's kitchen knife carving through a hog-tied gangster. The second came when Pesci shoots and kills Spider, the young man waiting on the wise guys at their poker game. Spider was played by Michael Imperioli, who went on to star as Christopher in The Sopranos. Marty thought the action was funny and revealing, but Warner Brothers found it gratuitous. I moved like Henry Kissinger between studio and client. After half the audience fled a Goodfellas test screening in Burbank, it was touch and go. Fearing the film might be canceled, I appealed to Marty to modify the stabbing, saying it really was too much, and also to cut some time so Goodfellas could play twice a night and have a chance at earning out. Passionate as Marty was, he was open to a good argument. He shortened Goodfellas to 145 minutes and made the first scene crisper and less gory. In return, I backed Marty in his determination to keep Spider's death intact. That scene exemplified his characteristic tone of savagely funny realism. To tamper with it would have been like telling Degas he couldn't use blue. The Warner Brothers executives were half an hour late for the next preview in suburban Orange County, and the audience was fidgeting before the lights went down. There were Pesci and De Niro butchering the hapless gangster, but no audio. The lights came back up, and after a delay, the projectionist tried to sync picture and sound and failed again. Marty was going nuts. No picture could get a fair screening after a long delay and two false starts. I hustled him across the street to a coffee shop. Bob Daley and Terry Semel followed. Seconds before they caught up, I whispered into my assistant Jay Maloney's ear. I heard Bob and Terry out as they pleaded for another try, and at last I said, "Okay, go ahead, but we won't participate." Marty shook his head violently, feeling betrayed. I led him to my car for the drive back to Los Angeles. He said, "Aren't we going in for the screening?" "Nope." "Why not?" At that instant, my car phone rang. I put it on speaker and heard a frantic Warner's executive wanting to know where the print was. They couldn't find it anywhere. Marty looked horrified. I said, "Oh, no, I can't imagine what happened." After I hung up, I explained to Marty that I told Jay Maloney to secure the film canisters and drop them in my trunk. Marty burst out laughing and could not stop. The next preview was glitch-free. Goodfellas came out that fall to near unanimous acclaim and went on to earn 6 Oscar nominations. For months in 1989, I pushed Marty to commit to Cape Fear, a remake of a noirish film from 1962 about a psychopathic ex-con named Max Cady, played by Robert Mitchum, out for revenge. It was commercial, it would fulfill Marty's deal with Universal, and I knew he'd nail it. "It's a remake," he kept saying. "I don't do remakes." That's what he'd said about sequels. It was an edict I knew I could work around. But there was a further problem with Cape Fear. Steven Spielberg, not Marty, controlled the rights. At the time, Steven had no agent, though I was working hard to rope him in. He'd caught wind of a script that Scorsese controlled, Schindler's List, and he couldn't stop thinking about it. Based on Schindler's Ark, a novel by Thomas Keneally, it told the story of a German industrialist who saved 1,000 Jews from the Nazi gas chambers. Steven saw Schindler's story as the ideal vehicle for an accessible movie about a monstrously difficult subject. It seemed to me that the wrong people were matched to the wrong projects. Steven needed a more culturally relevant film to broaden his profile. To get bigger, he had to go smaller. So I did what I always did. I represented the client before I actually, technically, represented him. "You know," I said to Marty, "I understand why you want to do Schindler's List, but you don't need to do it. Steven doesn't need another picture like Cape Fear. Why don't the two of you swap?" Marty was unconvinced. I tried again. "Look, you can cast Bobby in the Mitchum part and have a field day." Working with De Niro always appealed to Marty, but it was never easy to talk him into or out of anything. He had to work his way through it. He was as deeply Catholic as Steven was deeply Jewish. Religion permeated his movies, and he was eager to explore another faith. It would be wrenching for him to part with Schindler's List. From countless nights with Marty and his 16mm projector, I knew of his passion for genre movies, from horror to obscure Asian pictures, the bloodier the better. Years later, the Hong Kong drama Infernal Affairs, which he'd shown me in the 80s, would inspire his Oscar-winning The Departed. "Cape Fear could be something you've never achieved before, a Scorsese-style film noir," I said. "You'll create a truly sinister villain." Marty loved the dynamic in the original between the Mitchum character and the budding but innocent girl played by 14-year-old Laurie Martin. He created a similar vibe in Taxi Driver between De Niro and Jodie Foster, who was 13 at the time. 5 or 6 bruising conversations later, Marty was finally ready. I called Steven and said, "Marty has a terrific take on Cape Fear. You guys should talk." I set a call between Steven and Marty. They'd never had a business conversation, but given their shared intrepid spirit, I wasn't surprised to hear that they had hit it off. Hesitantly, Marty joined Steven in asking me to put the switch together. Within a week, they had an understanding. Steven agreed to produce Cape Fear, with Marty directing on the generous back-end deal, and Marty passed Schindler's List to Steven. In the midst of this statecraft, I took a call from another client. Stanley Kubrick said, "I hear that Marty's doing a Holocaust project." "That's not quite true," I said. "It looks like he might be trading with Spielberg. Because, you know, I've got one too." Stanley had grown up during World War II in a Jewish family in New York. He'd been thinking about making a Nazi Germany picture called The Aryan Papers for years. He made so few films because he treated each one like a doctoral thesis, nailing down every detail. It had stalled on his development list until the rumors about Schindler's List rekindled his interest. Now he wanted me to read his first draft screenplay and help me decide his next move. Because Stanley didn't send scripts out, and because he hadn't flown in 25 years, I went to see him in the English countryside at Chaldwickbury Manor, his enormous house in Hertfordshire. First, a messenger came to my hotel with the Aryan Papers script, sat outside my door as I read it, and collected it when I was done. It was tense reading because I knew there was room for only one Holocaust film. 2 would dilute the box office and spark unfortunate comparisons. Soon I'd be advising a Hall of Fame artist to surrender a passion project, either one of our most venerable clients or the director we most hoped to recruit. It was even more ticklish because the two directors formed a mutual admiration society. Stanley vocally admired the young director's work, and Steven felt the same way about The Shining in 2001 A Space Odyssey. They had hours-long phone calls, and Steven dropped by Stanley's house whenever he went to London, but Hollywood friendships had often been wrecked by lesser conflicts. I drove to Stanley's estate bearing bad news. The Aryan Papers wasn't as good or as commercial as Schindler's List. It had no complex protagonist, no Oscar Schindler, for an audience to engage with. And because Stanley took longer than Steven in development, plus 40 weeks or more to shoot, roughly twice the norm, he'd be in theaters second, putting him at a major disadvantage. We sat at the wooden picnic table in Stanley's kitchen. I told him Aryan Papers was too similar to Schindler's List and too derivative of Sophie's Choice, the acclaimed film from 8 years earlier. "It's just not Kubrick to be unoriginal," I said. Seeing that he was still uncertain, I lowered my voice and added, "Plus, in all candor, we just killed ourselves switching scripts between Marty and Steven." I only used the help me out for once card because I knew that what I wanted, in this case, was also what was right for Stanley. "I get that," he said gravely. The following week, he called Steven to tell him he was letting Aryan Papers go. His act of generosity brought the directors even closer, and they remained intimate friends until Kubrick's death in 1999. 2 years later, Steven completed Stanley's unfinished AI, artificial intelligence, and dedicated it to Stanley. Cape Fear would gross $182 million worldwide, more than 3 times Marty's record, and 17-year-old Juliette Lewis would earn an Oscar nomination for her not-so-innocent flirtation with De Niro. Schindler's List would win 7 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, and Steven's first Oscar for Best Director. Marty was happy. Steven was happy. Stanley was not unhappy. This was extremely unusual. It took Steven Spielberg 3 years after his swap with Marty to finish Schindler's List. Universal was in no hurry to get it done. Schindler struck the studio's execs as a more expensive Last Temptation of Christ, too, a hot-button topic that would repulse moviegoers. If Steven hadn't been Universal's meal ticket and hadn't worked on their lot where they had to see him every day, they probably wouldn't have warily backed it in the first place. Steven felt he had to shoot in Poland, where the events took place, but Sid Sheinberg said that was too expensive. After Steven won that round by accepting a bare-bones budget, the studio objected to his plan to film in black and white. Tom Pollock begged for color for the video market with a transfer to black and white for the theatrical release. Steven held firm. Color shoots, he said, made a transfer look pink and white. The dispute dragged on for weeks because Sid and Stephen were like family and it hurt them to fight. I had to jump in. I said that Stephen had an unambiguous vision of the Holocaust as life without light. Black and white was essential to that vision. Case closed. Schindler's List was filmed in Krakow in the dead of the Polish winter. As I flew over to meet Stephen there on other business, I began to feel jittery. I grew up with kids calling me a kike and was pummeled more than once when I fought back. But all my life, I had avoided thinking about the Holocaust because it enraged me that so many Jews had been so powerless and that the world stood by and let the atrocity happen. I arrived in the morning for a quick tour of the sets, including the death camp exteriors thrown up outside Auschwitz-Birkenau. 1 hour into the liquidation of the Krakow ghetto, with stone-faced men in Nazi uniforms everywhere, I felt like I was living in 1941. Stephen wanted to make the scene almost unwatchable, and he succeeded. As the Nazis raided a home and machine-gunned two Jews wedged between a mattress and a bedspring, I thought to myself, 6 million were killed, and I could have been one of them. I felt so nauseated I almost threw up. I spent that day in a walking stupor. As a boy, I'd asked my immigrant grandmother, why didn't the Jews fight back? Now I felt that I understood. The Jews didn't fight because they couldn't move. They were terrorized into paralysis. I had the same sense of paralysis on that set. That night, I joined Stephen and Kate Capshaw and his stepdaughter Jessica at their rented house nearby. I came with a proposal that we'd been working on for a year, an expansion of Amblin Entertainment, Stephen's production company, into a full-service studio. CAA would shepherd and commission Amblin's productions for a monthly consulting fee. The potential seemed limitless, and of course we'd finally land Stephen as a client. Shaking off my existential dread, or at least compartmentalizing like crazy, I gave it my best pitch over dinner. I was pitching Kate as much as Stephen because she was strict about family time. I always asked her permission before calling her husband after 6 p.m. As I spoke, I could see Kate shaking her head. She didn't want her husband toiling like Jeffrey Katzenberg, Eisner's studio chief at Disney. That man does nothing but work, she said. That's his whole life. My shiny idea was dead on arrival. A year later, with Katzenberg and David Geffen, Stephen founded DreamWorks SKG, the first new full-service studio in L.A. in 70 years. Kate gave it her okay because Jeffrey was one of the partners. She figured he would log the long hours while Stephen just made his films. And for as long as DreamWorks lasted, that's pretty much how it worked out. After Schindler's List was released, CAA gave $1 million to the Shoah Foundation, which Stephen had founded to preserve video testimonies by Holocaust survivors. It was more than our combined commissions on the film. I felt good about the donation, but my experience on the set highlighted the underlying problem with my life, because as soon as I got back to Los Angeles, I suppressed all the feelings that being on the set of the Holocaust had stirred up in me and went right back to scorching the earth for my clients. Yet, every time I saw the film, and we previewed it a lot, the experience hit me fresh again, and I took a beat to remember how lucky I was and to remember the fate of all those who weren't so lucky. That's what movies can do. Chapter 9. No Pressure. I grew up in an environment without paintings and sculpture. They didn't teach art at my high school, and my parents had no interest in it. The first time I saw art worth mentioning was when I drove to New York before starting at UCLA and went to the Metropolitan and the Museum of Modern Art. The sheer visual stimulation was so emotionally shocking that I felt like I was hallucinating. Art was everywhere in New York, in parks and squares and the lobbies of apartment buildings. It was only a 3-day visit, but I would never be the same. In my second year in college, I enrolled in the first of many art history courses, one of those slideshow surveys that range from caveman drawings to Jackson Pollock. It was the one class I'd literally run to. At William Morris, I began to collect young California artists such as Laddie John Dill and Chuck Arnaldi. I wasn't systematic. I bought what I liked and could afford. The next leap came after we started CAA and I began going to New York regularly. In the late 1970s, before Chris was born, I'd be in the city 2 or 3 Saturdays a month. After work, I'd squeeze in a few hours at the galleries and museums, often with Judy at my side, loving what I was seeing, though, for the most part, I had no idea what I was looking at. Minimal art in particular left me nonplussed. My tastes have changed. I now collect extensively in that area, but I didn't need to understand a piece to be moved by it. Art nourished me. The Museum of Modern Art became my home away from home. I could always find something new and exciting there, even in works I'd seen a dozen times before. Around this time, I met a close friend of Bill Haber's, a TV exec named Barry Lowen, who was assembling the most interesting collection of contemporary paintings and sculpture in Los Angeles. Barry was smart, curious, engaging, and involved. He was a founder of the Museum of Contemporary Art in downtown L.A. and a key supporter of the Los Angeles County Museum of Art. And he was one of the warmest guys I've ever known. Cultured and soft-spoken, he had an extraordinary eye for young artists such as Ellsworth Kelly and Cy Twombly, who could go the distance. We talked every other day, more about art or life than business, often over dinner at my house or his. After Barry became ill with AIDS, I stayed in touch daily to try to lift his spirits. He made me the executor of his estate and left me his vast art library, the core of my library today. Barry died in 1985 at the age of 50. Every now and then, I'll slide a book off the shelf and a slip will fall out with his name on it, a note about a picture he wanted me to look at. These visitations are poignant, but they always make me smile. My first big buy in 1976 was a Jasper Johns Gemini print, Periscope 1 Red, Yellow, Blue. It cost $600, and I felt trepidation as I wrote the check. Knowing that I needed guidance, Mort Janklow later set me up with his friend Arnie Glimcher at the Pace Gallery. I strolled through Arnie's showing room, feigning savoir-faire, wide-eyed at the price tags. He said, "I have something to show you." A minute later, I was staring at a Matisse. "A real bargain at $750,000," he said. The number seemed so surreal, I didn't know what to say. Afterward, I called Mort in a fury. "Who the hell is $750,000? Arnie, I complained, was a snob who'd made me feel like a rube. Mort chuckled and said, "Give him another try." So I did. After Arnie put in the time to guide me and help me to see the nuances of the works in front of me, I finally bought a major Bryce Marden from him for $60,000. Our phone calls were a welcome break from my work, and the guy I had written off became a close friend. When we traveled to Paris with our wives, Arnie showed me an artist's eye view of the city. He expanded my collecting into different mediums and periods. After he took me to primitivism at the Modern, which revealed how African masks inspired Picasso's cubist portraits, I returned 30 times. Today, a room in my house is dedicated to Picasso's and African masks. I feel a little charge of strangeness, which is what Picasso does to me every time I go in there. My growing art collection made me feel I'd escaped the valley at last, but escape is never painless. One day my dad came to our house in Brentwood and saw my first Picasso, which I'd bought for $100,000. He looked at it, looked at me, then looked away. Neither of us said anything. I bought my parents a large condo, and my dad was grateful, if a little embarrassed, that I was now taking care of them. My mother was grateful in a general way, but she complained that I never spent enough time with her. She was a guilt expert. She increasingly reminded me of a demanding client, the kind you can never satisfy no matter what you do. Families always want you to stay the person they think you were. A few years later, I saw Michael Mann's Last of the Mohicans. The film overwhelmed me. It was like a 112-minute oil painting. I called Michael from my car and said I had three words for him. The first was brilliant. The second and third were Albert Bierstadt, the 19th-century painter of luminous landscapes of the American West. Michael was surprised and pleased. "How did you know?" He said Bierstadt was an inspiration for him to make the movie. I felt happy hearing that because it ratified an idea I'd had for some time. As I'd become more involved in the New York art scene, I'd begun to see parallels between art and fashion and movies and television, a connection among all things creative. The more deeply I understood painters and sculptors, the better I related to film artists. Art deepened my feel for writers in particular. When one of them pitched me an idea, I had a stronger visual sense of its possibilities than before. I could see how it might work on the screen, or not work. I had a frame of reference for production design, even lighting and costumes. I could be a more useful part of the conversation. My affinity for Scorsese's work came from deep in that place. If you froze Marty's films, you could mount the individual frames. When Chris, our firstborn, was less than a year old, he got terribly sick with a systemic infection. It took a while for the doctors to diagnose him, and Judy and I were scared to death. Chris was still struggling when we ran out of his antibiotic at our weekend home in Malibu, where no drugstores were open on Sunday. I drove at top speed to St. Joan's Health Center in Santa Monica in my T-shirt and cut-off jeans and flip-flops. I rapped on the glass and told the druggist what I needed. Then I realized I'd forgotten my wallet. "Look," I said, "here's my number. Call my wife. She'll verify who I am." I must have sounded crazy. The man held up his hand and calmly said, "Take the script and bring me a check tomorrow." The next day, I returned with two checks, one for the prescription and one for a substantial donation. When I couldn't find anyone to take the second check, I called a board member listed on the hospital's brochure, Glenn McDaniel, the Litton Industries General Counsel. 6 months later, I joined the board myself and began working with Glenn on the St. John's Health Center Foundation. With Judy in charge, we organized an annual movie premiere around big CAA packages such as Ghostbusters and Out of Africa. We raised at least $2 million each time. As UCLA graduates, Judy and I later gravitated naturally to helping the university's medical center. It had no board at the time, just a doctor society that raised about $65,000 a year. We assembled a board of prominent people to engineer a kickoff fundraiser for 1,500 people at Fox. We enlisted CAA clients Chevy Chase and Crosby, Stills & Nash to entertain and raised another $2 million. I worked hard for UCLA in part because it proved extremely useful for CAA to be able to get our clients or potential clients the best medical care with one call, but even more because I believed in its mission and liked the idea of helping people, saving people. By 1985, we had about 600 clients. We'd gradually become a corporation, with button-down execs running large fiefs of our expanding empire. I'd gotten to know Ray Kurtzman at William Morris. By the time he replaced Sam Sachs as the lawyer who headed its 25-man group, he had already headed up both Columbia Pictures and the Mirisch Corporation, and produced such classics as The Guns of Navarone and The Magnificent Seven. Ray's office was next to mine, and we were friendly. He was short and soft-spoken and nondescript, but he wasn't afraid to raise his voice when someone was doing something shady or unprofessional. When our gang of five left to form CAA, it fell to Ray to collect the commissions we owed William Morris from pre-existing contracts, a sizable sum. The awkward circumstances kept us in touch. One day in 1978, I told him, "I can't offer anything close to what you're making, but we want you to come with us." Ray was in his 40s with three kids and a Beverly Hills mortgage. Leaving powerful William Morris for our startup was a gutsy risk. He'd be taking a 75% pay cut to $120,000, and we had no legal department other than him, but he didn't like the leadership at WMA, and he was ready for a gamble. He built our business affairs and legal departments from scratch and closed thousands of deals for us. Our agency turned over more of the details of contracts to our lawyers than other agencies did, so the agents could devote their hours to developing new business. But most important, he served as our grown-up. He was our 50s sitcom dad who lays down the law. Ray became the conscience of the agency, a personal mentor, and a close friend. I find it quietly pleasing that his son works at CAA today. Bob Goldman was my personal accountant before he became CAA's chief financial officer. Even quieter than Ray, he was equally professional and ego-free. He handled our real estate investments and tax matters, keeping our money safe. He and Ray helped keep CAA grounded and stable while the rest of us flung zip lines into distant treetops. The first 10 years at CAA were the best 10 years of my life. And it seemed, for the first few years after that, that everything just kept getting better. By the late 80s, CAA had become a story factory. Hundreds of scripts, treatments, articles, and novels poured into our office each month. 10 full-time readers generated 3- or 4-page synopses for our agents, who read the most promising material in full and brought it to staff meetings for review. On Friday, any of our agents could pitch me one-on-one, so each weekend I plowed through several scripts they'd recommended. Our packages were in full swing. ICM or William Morris might package half a dozen multi-client projects a year in TV and film. We assembled 30 or more. As a rule, we loaded artists into a film until their aggregate share of the producing studio's gross totaled 20% to 30%. If the film returned $100 million to the studio, our clients earned $20 million to $30 million. 10% of that was a handsome payday for CAA. $3 million in 1985 is the current equivalent of more than $7 million. We busted a gut for the money. We scrutinized the film's budget, gave notes on every rewrite, sat in on screenings, broke the news to the director if revisions were needed, then reviewed every ad for the finished picture. We trained our young agents in how to read by giving them a 1978 Esquire article by Aaron Latham, whom we represented, about a honky-tonk bar with a mechanical bull. The brightest of our up-and-comers could envision the article as a movie, which we'd made in 1980, the hit Urban Cowboy, written by Latham and director Jim Bridges and starring John Travolta and Deborah Winger. We put the same inspired hard work into our television and music projects. When the Wall Street Journal interviewed Aaron Spelling about Hollywood Wives, a Jackie Collins miniseries, and other series that we'd package for him, he called us his extramural creative staff. The joke around the industry was that our agents were like the Stepford Wives, well-paid, affable, driving shiny new cars, living the American dream. They were young, on average in their early 30s, 10 years younger than agents at our biggest rivals, and they were happy because it was all working, or at least as happy as agents can be. As the famous talent agent Swifty Lazar put it, "There hasn't been a phenomenon such as CAA since 1947, when Lou Wasserman and MCA dominated Hollywood. Comparing CAA to its strongest competition is like comparing Tiffany's to the A&P. I was beginning to have personal leverage, and it was a great feeling. It was like putting your foot on the gas pedal of a Ferrari and feeling the chesty rumble. When Wolfgang Puck opened Spago on the Sunset Strip in 1982, he introduced Los Angeles to a lighter California cuisine, smoked salmon pizza, squab on peaches, goat cheese galore. Judy and I became devotees of the place. Wolfgang made such great food, was such a charmer, and had such a disarming accent that I thought he deserved a larger audience. So in 1986, I took the president of ABC Entertainment, Lou Ehrlich, to dinner at Spago with his wife and Judy. I called Wolfgang beforehand and told him to cook the meal of his life and to pay particular attention to Lou. The food was excellent. Wolfgang was witty and engaging, and Lou personally polished off at least 2 of the 3 bottles of carefully chosen red wine that Wolfgang sent out. When Lou was good and hammered, I said to him, "Listen, you've got Julia Child doing cooking segments on Good Morning America. She's great, but why not give Wolfgang a trial of 3 appearances so you can bring in some younger, hipper viewers? As you can see, he's a natural. If he does well, he'd be a great regular contributor." Lou said, "You write it up and I'll sign the contract." At that point, he would have agreed to pretty much anything. "Great," I said. I pulled out a pen, drew up my plan on a napkin, and had Lou sign it. He called the next day to thank me for dinner, and after some chit-chat, I asked when Wolfgang could expect to go on the show. Lou said, "What are you talking about?" He had no memory of that part of the evening. I said, "I'll send the contract over." I had a kid from the mailroom drive to ABC's offices in Century City. He was immediately ushered into Lou's office. The kid opened his sports jacket, and there, safety pinned to his shirt, was the napkin Lou had signed. "Give me that," Lou said, reaching for it. "I'm sorry," the kid said, closing his jacket and backing away. "Mr. Ovitz told me to let you view the contract you signed and then return it to him." Lou wasn't too happy about it, but Wolfgang got his shot on air. The day before he went on, I sent around a memo telling everyone in the agency to have their relatives call ABC's switchboard the following morning, after Wolfgang's appearance, to say how much they loved the new chef. Switchboard calls were the network's way of measuring heat in the mid-80s, an early version of Twitter followers. ABC was blown away. I never pulled that trick again. It's something you can only do once, but it was all to help a genuine talent who would have made it as a TV personality on his own, just more slowly. and ABC could hardly complain that I'd pulled a fast one, as Wolfgang remains a regular on Good Morning America to this day. With my growing leverage, it became increasingly easier for me to help our artists expand their footprints into related fields. I knew that Steve Ross at Warner Brothers wanted to build an empire in which the right artists could excel in every facet of the business. Now we found ourselves representing such an artist, Madonna. After discussing her future with her manager, Freddie DeMann, and her lawyer, Alan Grubman, I told Steve that we had a client who could simultaneously showcase her talent and his company. "She's doing huge business on your record label," I said. "She's big in personal appearances. She was really good in Desperately Seeking Susan for Orion. She wants to write a book, and you own an imprint. Why don't you and I figure out how to cover all the things she can do?" Steve was game, so Freddie and Alan and I went to work. First, we had to enlist Time Warner's division chiefs, who had considerable autonomy. Madonna was Warner Music's hit machine, and Mo Austin, the label's president, didn't want her distracted. Somehow, we cajoled him into a meeting in New York. The toughest sell was Bob Daley, who didn't need Madonna in his movies, but he agreed to come too. So did Larry Kirschbaum, who ran Warner Books. Sometimes stardom happens by accident. You're Peter Frampton and everybody starts buying your live album just because. You sell 16 million units, then you fade away. But Madonna was no fluke. I met her when she was 19 and Freddie DeMann brought her to our Century City offices. She took the whole meeting with her head on the table like a bored teenager, but she absorbed every word. She called me Mr. Ovitz then and later, seeing me as a suit-wearing grown-up. Yet of all of CAA's clients, she was the best at expanding her brand. Despite her extreme persona, she was disciplined, focused, and cultured. When we met with Steve and his chieftains, Madonna sat at the circular table and studied a lengthy outline she'd written in fountain pen. As we got started, one of Alan Grubman's partners spilled his water glass all over Madonna's notes, rendering them illegible. Though obviously upset, she composed herself and spoke off the cuff. She talked about movie development and TV production and how they could play off her music and vice versa. She pitched a sex book. She pitched every aspect of her brand working for Steve's empire. He was so impressed that we signed an unprecedented omnibus deal. Some of Madonna's ideas worked out great. Her sex book, with its metallic cover, sold 500,000 copies in 1 week. But she never made it as an actress. No one can do everything perfectly. I was now able to put executives in place at the studios and then sell our projects to them, controlling both supply and demand. By 1984, after Michael Eisner wasn't chosen to succeed Barry Diller at Paramount, he knew he had no future there. Fortunately, another studio needed new leadership. Disney was hurting in film and TV, and hurting even worse in merchandising. Its overseas business was next to non-existent. CEO Ron Miller, Walt Disney's son-in-law, left for the day at 2 o'clock. Michael and his running mate, Frank Wells, campaigned for the job with every board member they could find, but they had no entree to Sam Williams, the state bar chairman who headed Disney's search committee. Sam practiced at a downtown L.A. law firm whose senior partner, Seth Hufstedler, was my personal attorney. In those days, the Los Angeles business community was split between downtown and West L.A., and one had little to do with the other. The lead contender to replace Ron Miller, Dennis Stanfill, was a downtown favorite. He looked like a shoe-in. At the 11th hour, I set up a secret rendezvous in Orange County so Frank and Michael could meet with Sam Williams. They wowed him. Later, I prepped Michael for his first meeting with Sid Bass, the art-collecting oil man who was about to become Disney's largest shareholder. To keep Michael from coming off as a one-dimensional entertainment guy, I briefed him on every painting in Bass's home. Disney offered Wells the top spot as chairman and CEO, with Eisner as president. Michael told Frank he wouldn't serve as his number two, and the jobs were flipped. Boy, do I wish Frank had told Michael to take a hike at that point. It would have saved me a world of hurt later, but Frank was too nice, too conflict-averse. And, he told me later, he didn't think he was as creatively qualified as Michael. If he'd taken the top job, Eisner would have walked, and then Frank would have had to go find someone else he liked who had a knack for story. It wasn't easy to find someone who could read a script as shrewdly as a spreadsheet. There were only a handful besides Eisner, including David Geffen, Barry Diller, Terry Semel, Bob Daly, and Frank Price. Over the next 10 years, Michael turned Disney around and made it a real power, with crucial support from Frank and from his studio head Jeffrey Katzenberg. CAA was perfectly positioned to profit from the relationship, but we never did much business with Disney. They just wouldn't pay market price. My technique and confidence had become such that I felt that if I could get in a room with a client, any client, I could sign him or her. My record was pretty good. James L. Brooks simply refused to leave ICM, though I busted my ass trying. I had to unsign Arnold Schwarzenegger after signing him because Sly Stallone felt threatened and blew up at Ron. Sly was one of the few who didn't buy our no conflicts, no interest theory. But Arnold came over later, and I couldn't land Mel Gibson because he wanted to pay just 5% in commissions. But that was about it. Every actor, writer, or director believes he or she is responsible for his or her own success. All I did was sell that belief back to them. Look, you're going to make it with or without us, I'd say. But we can keep you at the top because we see every project first, we develop for you, we represent every important studio executive so we can match you with the perfect projects, and we take care of all your other personal needs so you can focus on your work. Going with us is just like taking out career insurance. A lot of agents preyed on people's anxiety and desperation, pitching themselves as a golden ticket. You can't make it without me. To me, that went against the grain of human nature. If a potential client was reluctant, I'd say, you should take all the time you need. No pressure. And by no pressure, I meant no pressure until the next time I'm in touch, which may be in an hour. I tried to avoid coming across as a nudge while making myself ubiquitous and inexorable. The smarter clients could see what I was doing, see how it worked, but it worked nonetheless because everyone wants to be wanted. And the realization that your would-be agent has a plan to handle whatever may be coming and that he can execute it is reassuring. I signed Kevin Costner in 1989 in part by convincing him that he needed to take $3 million for directing and starring in his passion project, Dances with Wolves. He wanted to take just $1 million to keep the cost down so it could get made. I told him he had to trust me and that he'd understand why later. So he took the $3 million, and when the production ran out of money, as I knew it would, first-time directors on big projects always run out of money, he was able to draw on the extra salary to finish shooting. I'd gotten him the insurance he needed to finish his dream film. Creating a zone of calm in a chronically overexcited world proved disarming. Whenever disputes arose with a studio, and I had to deal with an exec sputtering with outrage, I'd go even calmer and say, I'm confused about something, or slightly more aggressively, could you educate me? They're expecting you to ream them, and you've put them at ease by being neutral and mildly curious. Also, you've gotten them talking, and you're learning. It preserves your options. Another move I developed almost unconsciously was ground shifting. If someone on the other side of the table very confidently asserted a number that was confidential or that was plausibly in dispute, the budget of a rival studio's competing film, for instance, I would instantly say, it's higher or it's lower, depending on which served our interests. That assertion would throw the other guy off balance and suggest that I knew everything, when in truth I only knew some things. At the very least, it would give me a gauge of how solid their information was and how confident they were. If they fired right back with, no, you're absolutely wrong, I'd just say, that's not what I'm hearing from the highest levels, or something equally ominous, then change the topic. I resented it when people called these techniques agent tricks. I viewed them as tactics for achieving a preconceived strategy. My whole affect was transactional. I was soft-spoken because I wanted people to have to work hard to hear me, to have to move closer. When I did explode, which was rare, it was almost always expedient. When an agent named Rob Rothman left us for Jim Berkus's agency, which later merged into UTA, I screamed at him, I'm going to make your life a living hell. It was the Hail Mary after I'd done everything I could to express how much we wanted him to stay. Then, and only then, did I pick up the club and threatened to drop him into a boiling lake of fire. You want the guy to reconsider. Do I regret screaming those sorts of threats, as I did whenever an agent left us? Yes and no. Yes, because it never worked, and because it reinforced my image as a vindictive bastard. No, because it's who I had to be. My recurring nightmare was a big public event where the name of a client or potential client might escape me. I took to having one or two assistants study the guild's mugshots and shadow me, warning me sotto voce when they spotted a relevant face. Even then, I feared I'd blow it. I had a huge zone of protection around me, 5 assistants, and it never felt like enough. One assistant, such as Richard Lovett or David O'Connor, was being trained to become an agent. 2 handled incoming and outgoing calls. 1 was in charge of my schedule, and 1 just gave gifts. We instituted CAA's famous gifts office in the late 70s on the uncontroversial theory that people love free stuff. I had learned about gifting from my father with his bottles of Seagram's, so one of my assistants kept track of all our clients' hobbies and charities. When an agent found out some new bit of relevant data, Tom Hanks is taking scuba lessons or the like, it got passed to the gifts assistant via a buck slip or interoffice memo. The next time the client had a birthday or a book coming out or a movie shooting, he'd get an outdoor watch or a nice piece of luggage or, say, for Paul Newman and Tom Cruise on The Color of Money, an ornate pool cue. When Ron told me Sylvester Stallone admired my old Ferrari, I gave Sly the title. When Laverne and Shirley became a hit, and I kept redoing Penny Marshall's deal, I told Paramount's Gary Nardino, by the way, add a washer and dryer as a gift, from you to Penny. We pioneered the start date gift, the $500 survival kit food basket that would arrive in an actor's dressing room on some remote set in Malta or New Zealand the first day of shooting. We gave them to non-clients, too, working the theory that a non-client is just a future client who hasn't realized it yet. A typical memo from my right-arm Susan Miller, covering a 3-week period of birthday presents, noted that I had given, among many other gifts, Dustin an E-Tac, Armion Bernstein a City of Nets book, Walter Yetnikoff AKG headphones, Robert De Niro a Futurismo book, large Matisse book and several CDs, his father was a painter, Robert Redford a Malcolm Morley print, Terry and Jane Semmel some Abrams art books, Sean Connery, AKG headphones. Michael Jackson, a personalized robe and Hollywood musicals book. Except for start date gifts, my rule was that important gifts shouldn't be disposable. No champagne, no muffin baskets. Instead, rare first editions from heritage books, ancient Greek coins, paintings, and prints, even the occasional car. Sturdy, thoughtful presents that would last. If a client was paying us $500,000 a year in commissions, and we spent $5,000 on a gift for him or her, it didn't hurt us much, and it made the client feel fabulous. Our gifts office spent more than $500,000 a year and generated a ton of goodwill, though we did send one writer for The Simpsons the same Weber grill on 3 separate occasions. Every Christmas we gave Tiffany key rings or the like to the secretaries of our favorite executives, and we messengered over $500 to $1,000 to our favorite restaurant owners and maitre d's, those who'd made us seem more important at the beginning than we actually were. Ronnie, Tommy, Julius, and Pearl at Chasen's, Francois and Anna at Harry's Bar, Tom at Yamamoto's, Mary Lou and Monty at Scandia, Peter and Pam at Morton's, Nobu at Matsuhisa, Giorgio and Elena at Giorgio's, Jimmy and David at Jimmy's, Gigi at the Palm, and on and on. I had 2 assistants handling calls because the calls never ceased. I'd look at the phone logs every morning and afternoon and put dots next to each message in red ink. 5 dots meant call back right now. 4 dots was call within 30 minutes. 3 was call before next meal. 2 was call by end of day. And 1 dot signaled call before end of week. Even the most important clients wouldn't necessarily get a return call right away. When I signed Marty Scorsese, I told him, I'm not going to spend an hour on the phone with you a day, then I can't be doing everything else I need to do to find out what's going on, and I'm worthless to you. So when Marty called me, if it wasn't a crisis, one of my assistants would say, he's tied up, but he'll be back to you by the end of the day. Then Jay Maloney would call back for me, talk to Marty for an hour, and write up a buck slip explaining why Marty had called. The buck slips themselves would be ranked in order of importance. The rule was that if a buck slip contained a question, it had to be replied to by the end of the day, and I'd call whoever needed my attention most. If we were trying to transition a client whom I'd signed to the agent who'd be handling him day to day, I'd keep having that younger guy call back for me. And usually by the time I got back to Al Pacino, say, he was fine with having his daily business handled by Rick Nocita. All the senior people